who is a boy, there's a plaque to the memory of Edgar Wallace. Edgar Wallace, reporter. Born London, 1875. Died Hollywood, 1932. Founder member of the Company of Newspaper Makers. He knew wealth and poverty, yet had walked with kings and kept his bearing. Of his talents, he gave lavishly to authorship, but to Fleet Street, he gave his heart. Clubland Heroes. Iron to Win presents a series of portraits of the creators of the Clubland Heroes, heroes who are still often portrayed in the cinema and on television. This week, he examines the books of Edgar Wallace.
In 27 years, he published 175 novels, 15 plays, and countless articles for newspapers and magazines. Edgar Wallace was a phenomenon, fully deserving the slogan that appeared on the dust jackets of his books. It's impossible not to be thrilled by Edgar Wallace. When Margaret Lane, his biographer, first met him, she was a young reporter, sent along to interview the great man, then at the height of his fame.
I remember that one could see that he was doing his act. There was this persona, the rather drooping eyelids, the rather massive presence, the air of well-being and calm and very welcoming to a young person. I was, I think, in my first job in Fleet Street at the time, and a little bit nervous at going to interview the great man. And he made it all very easy, and he was a real pro in that respect. And then when, some months later, my news editor made me ring him up about something, and I thought he would, of course, never remember that I had met him before, and just gave him my name, and he said, "Is that my Miss Lane?" in the most comforting and friendly way. I'm not an addict of thrillers and whodunits. It wasn't his work that drew me to the job of writing his biography. It was the man and his history, which is a fabulous story, so full of adventure, right from the early days. This almost foundling child, this unwanted little bastard that the poor travelling actress has got to get rid of somehow, and unloads him onto a Billingsgate fish porter and his wife, and he grows up in extreme poverty.
At 10 or thereabouts, I became a sort of associate member of a gang of burglars. They stole type from a type founder's. I never took part in the raids, carried out under the direction of a desperado, very little older than myself. But I received a little of the loot and regretted that it was not more useful. And about now, I met a man who asked me to buy him cigarettes, a penneth at a time. He gave me nice new florins, and I bought him back the change. After I'd changed five, I took the sixth to the dearest policeman and said, "If you please, sir, is this money snide?" He broke it with his finger and thumb and said that it was snide. So my employer was pinched, and the magistrate said I was a smart little boy. I kept the news of the world cutting for a long time. It was the first time my name ever appeared in print.
And it was to be some time before his name appeared in print again. His mother had given him the name Richard Horatio Edgar Wallace, but that seemed a bit highfalutin to George Freeman, the Billingsgate fish porter and his wife who'd adopted him. To them, he was just plain Dick. But if Edgar's mother was too poor to give her son a proper home, her influence was felt, for the theatre was in the boy's blood. He spent all his spare time in the galleries of local theatres and music halls, and when he left school, he tried a number of jobs, but none of them lasted for long. They just weren't exciting enough.
And then eventually, remember when he'd run away when he was, I suppose about 12, and gone up the East Coast and got a job on a trawler, which he hated so much he ran away again. And it took him 3 weeks without a penny and on foot, stealing and scrounging all the way, to get back to Billingsgate and his adopted parents. Well, that's not romantic fantasy. It's the sort of adventure that very few boys come through unscathed. So he had the toughness of the travelling player who could endure being hungry and cold, and then the next week perhaps have a good night and be full of drink and jollity. He had that very strongly in his character.
Young Dick needed excitement. Back in London, he worked as a milkman and a labourer, but eventually, depressed with life in City Street, he enlisted for 7 years in the army, first as a private in the Royal Northwest Kent Regiment, before transferring to what he saw as the softer, more congenial life of the Medical Staff Corps, which gave him time to read. There he also tried his hand at writing verses to keep his chums amused, but the theatre was never far away, and in particular, he became enthralled by a music hall comedian, Arthur Roberts, for whom, with a nerve that was to characterise Edgar Wallace's career, he wrote a song.
It's a sort of a kind of a funny, peculiar feeling. A miserable, sappy, a silly and happy, ridiculous sort of a feeling. You have an idea that you look rather queer when you saw the young lady you're nearing. It's a kind of a sort of a, cannot describe it, all over alike sort of feeling.
Arthur Roberts was at the height of his fame. And greatly daring, I sent him a lyric called A Sort of a Kind of a. I was stunned one morning to hear from him that my first literary effort was successful. The day I was to go to town to hear it, I was made a prisoner at large for some military offence. Nevertheless, I went and stayed absent for 5 days. On my return, I was charged with the being a prisoner at large, Private Wallace broke out of barracks and remained absent until apprehended by the military police. Old Colonel Cleary glared at me over his glasses and said, "You'll go to prison with hard labour for 96 hours.
Half a packet, as a 96-hour stretch was known, did little to damage Edgar's career. Within a few months, he was promoted and dispatched to South Africa. The year was 1896. The Boer War was still 3 years away, and Edgar had time on his hands. He read incessantly, discovering Rudyard Kipling, and started writing poetry in the great man's image. When it was announced that Kipling was to pay a visit to South Africa, Edgar sent some verses to the Cape Times.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Kipling. You are welcome to our shores, to the land of millionaires and potted meat, to the country of the Fontaines. We have got no baths or pores. To the place where diamonds lay about the street at your feet, to the hunting ground of raiders indiscreet. We should like to come and meet you, but we can't without a pass. Even then we'd hardly like to make a fuss. For out here they've got a notion that a Tommy isn't class. He's a sort of brainless animal, or wuss, vicious cuss. No, they don't expect intelligence from us. Since the time when Tommy's uniform was musketoon and wig, there has always been a bloke what had a way of writing of the glory and forgetting the fatigue, who saw him in his tunic day by day, smart and gay, and forgot about the smallness of his pay.
As a result, Edgar was presented to Kipling, even going on to dine with him. But when the young soldier announced that he had literary ambitions, Kipling replied, "For God's sake, don't take to literature as a profession. Literature is a splendid mistress, but a bad wife." Undaunted, Edgar borrowed £18 and bought himself out of the army. Poetry, he discovered, paid badly, but journalism offered at least a living wage and plenty of fun. And with the Boer War, it also became highly profitable, particularly when Edgar scooped the world with the first news of a peace treaty between the Boers and the British.
Fortunately for me, there was a good pal of mine in the camp, a Tommy with whom I'd soldiered, and meeting him, I arranged a code of signals. He was to have 3 handkerchiefs, one red, one white, one blue. The railway ran within sight of the camp, and every morning I journeyed down the Vaal River by train and took the next train back, keeping my eye on the camp for the signal. Red meant nothing doing, blue making progress, and the white handkerchief was to signify that the peace treaty had actually been signed. Well, I don't know how many journeys I made on that infernal railway, but never once was the red handkerchief displayed. Then one morning, when rumour was rife that the negotiations had fallen through, I saw my friend standing on the end of the tent line, and he was displaying a white handkerchief.
He may have made his name, but in journalism, one scoop doesn't make a career. Back in Britain, he joined the Daily Mail, temporarily edited the Evening News, and got one or two good stories, but it was not enough. Edgar wanted nothing less than to make his fortune. he turned to fiction, and recalling a boyhood admiration for Sexton Blake, he decided on a thriller to be called The Four Just Men. But this was to be a thriller with a difference. The public would provide the solution to the mystery.
Welby and the chief kept the matter a secret till half an hour before the paper went to press. But at 11:30, the buzzing hive of Megaphone House began to hum. For then it was that the sub-editors learned for the first time of the outrage. It was a great story. Yet another Megaphone scoop, headlined half down the page with "The Just Four Again." Outrage at the office of the Megaphone. Devilish ingenuity. Another threatening letter. The four will keep their promise. Remarkable document. Will the police save Sir Philip Raymond? "A very good story," said the chief complacently, reading the proofs. He was preparing to leave and was speaking to Welby by the door. "Not bad," said the discriminating Welby. "What I think." "Hello." The last was addressed to a messenger who appeared with a stranger.
"Gentleman wants to speak to somebody, sir. Bit excited, so I brought him up. He's a foreigner and I can't understand him, so I brought him to you."
This to Welby. "What do you want?" asked the chief in French. The man shook his head and said a few words in a strange tongue.
"Ah," said Welby, "Spanish. What do you wish?" he said in that language. "Is this the office of that paper?"
The man produced a grimy copy of the Megaphone.
"Yes." "Can I speak to the editor?"
The chief looked suspicious. "I am the editor," he said. The man looked over his shoulder, then leant forward.
"I am one of the four just men."
Welby took a step towards him and scrutinized him closely. "What is your name?" he asked quickly.
"Miguel Pere of Jerez," replied the man.
Edgar spent £1,000, which he hadn't got, on publicizing the four just men, and he offered £500 in prizes, which he also hadn't got, for the best solutions. In his foolhardy way, he was convinced that the four just men would sell so well that he would earn enough to pay off his debts and leave plenty to spare. But letters flooded into the Daily Mail denouncing the competition as fraudulent, and Alfred Harmsworth, the paper's proprietor, had to bail him out. But soon Harmsworth was forced to dig even deeper into his pocket. Two libel actions, thanks in part to Edgar inventing or failing to check stories, cost Harmsworth over £250,000 in settlements. While the legal processes dragged on, Edgar was sent back to Africa, this time to the Congo, to investigate allegations of brutality by the Belgian rubber companies against their native employees. Edgar's articles were never published, for reasons which seem unclear 75 years later, but the Congo was to provide inspiration for the fiction that was to make his reputation. Stories that are surely among his best work, Sanders of the River. The idea for Sanders of the River came from the editor of a magazine, The Weekly Tale Teller, who, on hearing Edgar reminisce about the Congo, asked him to write some African stories. Mr. Commissioner Sanders was an archetypal hero, the perfect administrator, not afraid to take the law into his own hands, and revered by the natives. There was also a rascally native chief, and later a silly ass character, Lieutenant Tibbetts, known affectionately as Bones.
Lieutenant Tibbetts, coming to breakfast one fiery morning, discovered a folded sheet of foolscap paper beneath his plate.
"Ha! Monday, sir," said he with an extravagant start, as though the discovery that this was indeed the second day of the week came in the nature of a shock. "And orders of the week as per regulations."
"Read 'em, you lazy devil." "A fellow," said Hamilton, catching his sister's reproving eye.
"Quite unnecessary, my jolly old tyrant," said Bones airily, as he shook his serviette free with a loud flap and all but caught Mr. Commissioner Sanders' coffee cup. "Quite superfluous. I know him by heart."
"Read it," suggested Hamilton. With a hoist of his shoulders, Bones opened the paper and read.
"Orderly officer for the week, Lieutenant Tibbetts. Field training in accordance with paragraph... Lieutenant Tibbetts. As expected."
"Hello, dear old sir.
What's this?"
"On the erection of the new flagstaff and signal yard, Lieutenant Tibbetts will assume the duties of OC signals. He will be responsible for the maintenance in good condition of the signal locker and flags, code books..."
"They're sending the pole down from HQ administration," explained Hamilton. "And it should be up by the end of the week. Do you know anything about signals, Bones?"
"I won't deceive you," said Bowen solemnly. I do. And this he proved. For when the great new flagstaff had been erected, and the government tug, which had towed the pole to the beach, had turned its nose for home, Bones, with the aid of the government code book, signalled, Wish you pleasant voyage. Whereupon the tug spun round and came back at full speed.
The signal flag's HLMI, sir, said the exasperated skipper of the tug. Do not mean wish you pleasant voyage, but return at once, natives in revolt.
Dear me, said Bones. How jolly romantic.
This was to be the making of Edgar. Soon his old abhorrence had returned, and he was back in Fleet Street.
Mentally, he could organize ideas very rapidly and present them well. And therefore, in the long catalogue of disasters he had in his early jobs, I mean, either getting promoted rapidly to be the editor of a South African newspaper and then getting sacked even more rapidly for some reason or other, and then his adventures in Africa and the Congo, and then probably getting sacked again and finding himself back in Fleet Street without a farthing, and presenting himself and his ideas and getting another job on a newspaper and working his way practically to the top, and then getting sacked for some gaffe or other. It never seemed to do him any harm. He always bounced back because he had an immensely fertile mind. He was always full of good ideas.
And the flow of ideas never failed him. Throughout the rest of his life, he poured forth books and plays at a speed that led to the joke, Have you read The Midday Wallace?
He would work very concentratedly, as if a current built up in him. And he used to sit and think before he started. He would have a minute or two thought, and he would put his hands together as if the current almost passed through them. And after that, he never hesitated. He could switch from an article on should women wear high heels to what's going to win the Manchester November Handicap, like that, absolutely without, his mind would switch over instantly. And if he'd been working very hard, very long hours without a break, he had his own way of knowing when it was wise to switch off. He would put his hand on his head very tenderly like that, and he said he had a place on the top of his head that used to get very hot. And if it did, he'd stop.
He had a gift, which Samuel Johnson, I believe, also had, that an idea would occur to him, and while he was doing quite other things, maybe going to a race meeting or reporting something in the law courts that he wasn't much attending to, some part of his brain was organizing this idea and manufacturing it into a saleable material. And therefore, when he got home and enclosed in his draft-proof room with his glass screen round him and his dictaphone, he could dictate it almost without pause. He hadn't got to start at the beginning and organize and think it out.
When he came back from a trip to America and told me he had a wonderful idea for a play. Then he came here to Chalklands, and at midnight, I think it was a Tuesday, he rang up and said, the car is on its way. I'm going to start the play now. So I came down. It was about 1 o'clock. And he started dictating and finished dictating the first act. I knew roughly what the characters were, but he acted the parts, and you just guessed who they were once he got into dictation. When I finished, he finished dictating the first act and went to bed, and I typed it. When he got up in the morning, he dictated the second act. And while I was typing, he corrected the first one. Then he had another nap in the afternoon, and he dictated the third act. And while I was typing that, he corrected the second act. By the end of by midnight of that day, we had the whole play in draft.
As far back as his days in South Africa, he'd written a play about Cecil Rhodes, but now he was writing for Gerald Du Maurier, who'd had such a success with Sapper's Bulldog Drummond 5 years earlier. Now the vehicle was an adaptation of Edgar's novel The Gaunt Stranger, renamed The Ringer. The actress, Dorothy Dixon.
The Ringer was a smash hit. I mean, there's never an empty seat in the house, you know. And although Edgar's name was a world name, and you could see it on the buses advertising his books and his articles. What really gave him a big kick was this success in the theater, which he hadn't had before. And so he would come down about three nights a week, just in time to watch the end of the first act, which was really very effective and got a sort of pin drop silence from the audience. And he'd come walking back into the dressing room with his wonderful smile and say, "Well, it worked again, didn't it?" And I said, "Yes, it always works."
But it wasn't as simple as that. Du Maurier, as he had with Bulldog Drummond, rewrote almost every line. But the years of burning the midnight oil, sustaining himself with hot sweet tea, had taken their toll. He fell victim to diabetes, and in Hollywood he died. Back in London, Emlyn Williams saw the news on an evening newspaper placard.
I would stand and looked at people there, literally, you could call them the man in the street, and they were looking at the poster as I had. It was a great figure that had vanished, and to me it was like suddenly hearing of a great engine, a railway engine, you could say, that's on its side, that's been stoked with wonderful fire and sparking away for years, and suddenly it's on its side and empty, and the wheels going around, there's nothing working, and you realize that it was over.
I think he always wanted to be rich and somebody, because I've always had the feeling that the talents he had could have made a great writer if he hadn't been so intent on mass production and popular success. I remember there was one critic, was it Edward Shanks, who once spoke of him as a lost Dickens. And that's always impressed me, because if you look into that little volume, originally called People, which is his own account of his early beginnings, there are whole passages in that which could have been written by Dickens. They're funny, they're touching, they're pathetic, they're completely real. And I think if he'd followed that vein and had wanted to be a great writer rather than a great financial success, he possibly could have been.
It was during the summer holidays of 1886 that I began my business career. Unknown to the Freemans, I went to London and was initiated into the mysteries of sale or return. The paper I chose was The Echo, a bilious-looking sheet that was remarkable for its high moral tone and the accuracy of its tips. On a summer afternoon, I appeared outside Cook's office at Ludgate Hill, beneath the windows of the very club of which I was one day to be chairman, with a bundle of Echoes under my arm. It was an enthralling experience. I stood in the very centre of London. Past me rumbled the horse buses, the drays and wagons of the great metropolis. My earnings averaged, I guess, about 3 shillings a week, which I spent in dissipation. Ginger beer, theatres, and a succulent toffee called Devona.
In the fourth of our series, Clubland Heroes, Iron Trewin has been looking at the books of Edgar Wallace. The readers were Edward Cust and Michael MacLean, and the producer was John Knight.
This is BBC Radio 4.
From the BBC Radio newsroom, this is Pauline Bushnell with the news at midnight. Rioting and looting have broken out in South London tonight. 85 policemen have been hurt in street clashes in Brixton. Petrol bombs were thrown at police officers, and more than 80 people were arrested. The area is now quieter. President Reagan has now left hospital, but his doctors have told him not to become involved in day-to-day government affairs for the time being. Space scientists at Cape Canaveral say they've rectified the computer fault on the space shuttle. Liftoff is now due in about 13 hours. Civil servants continuing their campaign for higher pay say they're planning to disrupt Easter holiday travel. In the FA Cup semi-finals, Manchester City beat Ipswich, but Tottenham and Wolves will have to play again. In Scotland, Rangers beat Morton. There will be a replay between Celtic and Dundee United. In the test match in Jamaica, the West Indies are 92 runs behind, with 7 wickets in hand. There's been a serious outbreak of rioting and looting in South London tonight. Hundreds of black and white youths